Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Hala Gores, and with me in the studio here at KBOO Community Radio is Will Seaman. Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners.
Good morning, and this morning we have two guests by telephone to talk about the evolving Obama administration policies towards Palestine-Israel.
A little later, we'll be talking with a leading authority on the politics of the Middle East, Dr. Jamal Nassar, the Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences at Cal State University in San Bernardino. But we begin this morning with a local friend and colleague, Steve Neva.
Steve Neva is professor of International Politics and Middle East Studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. His research and writing is focused on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, Islamist movements, and asymmetrical and insurgent warfare. He is a writer and editor for Middle East Report magazine. And his work has also appeared in Foreign Policy in Focus, Peace Review, Middle East International, Al Aram Weekly, The Seattle Times and The Post Intelligencer, Open Democracy, Z Magazine, Common Dreams, and many other publications. He is currently wrapping up a book on the history of Palestinian suicide bombings and their relationship to Israeli military violence, particularly Israel's assassination policy. Professor Neva, welcome to One Land, Many Voices.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Professor Neva, if I could start with the events of recent days. Reading the news reports, one might think that there is a conflict emerging between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government in Israel, specifically over the expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and in Jerusalem specifically. Has there been a shift in U.S. policy, and are we seeing a genuine challenge to business as usual for U.S. foreign policy toward this conflict?
Well, we're definitely seeing a shift. And the shift actually reminds me of back in the early 90s with the Bush senior administration, when he finally took on Israel regarding several issues, including settlements, and actually went ahead and suspended loan guarantees for a brief period. Obama's come into office, and he clearly has decided that he wants to get the process moving between Israel and Palestine, and Israelis and the Palestinians. And so what he's decided to do is he's decided... Probably, it seems to me it's like a four-part plan. The first part of it is he wants to create a slight rift with the Israeli government, the current Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu. And to do that, what he's done is he's chosen an issue that he thinks that he can probably win on, which is a settlement freeze. It's an issue that settlement expansion in the West Bank is not an issue that a lot of Israelis or Americans line up behind. And so what he's decided to do is pick an issue, create a slight rift, and maybe break the monopoly that's existed in the past, certainly the past 8 years, of the sort of greater Israel factions, both in the U.S. and in Israel, that is, those who support the Israeli settlement project. Because he knows what he has to do to head towards a peaceful resolution of some kind is he has to create some movement to slowing down the settlements, to shifting the conversation towards what he wants, which is heading towards a two-state solution.
And what are the prospects, given that you were just there in March and had a chance to see how the situation in the occupied territories has evolved in recent years, what are the prospects of that two-state solution these days?
Well, I mean, that is the important question. I mean, there's really two questions here. The first question is, will the Obama strategy work? I mean, you know, he's clearly breaking with the past. He wants to create a slight rift with Israel. He wants to get the process moving forward. I forgot to add that he's got a few other ideas here. One is, if he can break Netanyahu, let's say he could get Israel to agree to a settlement freeze or bring Netanyahu's government down because he pushed them hard, then what he'd have to do is, he'd like to get some sort of Arab concessions, that is, create sort of an Arab process, because he realizes Palestinians have nothing left to give Israel. And he creates sort of some Arab concessions, maybe some sort of normalization with Israel of some kind, trade relations or something. And then I think what he'd like to do is get a sort of negotiated process going with all the Arab states in Israel and with the Palestinians. So the question is, and I think it's an interesting strategy, you know, that basically he's trying to shift the conversation. However, the real question is it going to work, and is it really desirable or even possible? And on the first part, I'm not sure it will work. I mean, you have very powerful entrenched interests in the U.S. that don't want to see progress on this issue. Certainly don't want to see Israeli settlements being dismantled, which really is the key. I mean, Obama's calling for a settlement freeze, but ultimately the key issue towards any kind of viable Palestinian state would be getting rid of the settlements altogether. You know, there's 120 settlements in the West Bank, 500,000 Israeli settlers, 200,000 in East Jerusalem, 300,000 in the West Bank. I mean, that's really the obstacle to any kind of possible Palestinian state. And I mean, a settlement freeze is important, but it's actually something quite small. It's just no further expansion of settlements, no new settlements, etc. It's not removing the settlements, which is really ultimately the key issue here. So is that even possible? You know, if Obama loses on health care, if he loses on other issues, I mean, Obama's a pragmatist. Will he decide to throw all his political weight into really continuing this process of sort of creating a rift with Israel and pushing forward? I don't know. The other question that I think that you're asking me, Will, is it really possible on the ground? And having just been there, I have serious doubts that the two-state solution idea that really is at the end of the line, you know, the end of the idea here for the Obama administration, I think for many, is any longer feasible. What's happened in the West Bank in particular, and Gaza's connected to this, is that Israel has essentially created a ghetto system across the West Bank. In other words, by building settlements, by building walls, by building the road networks and the infrastructure that connect the settlements, Israel's engaged in a process of what I would call colonial urbanism. In other words, the native population has been overbuilt by a colonial settler population, and their connections, their connectivity, their contiguity has been severed by this overlay of Israeli settlements. In other words, Israel has totally changed the territorial configuration of the land, and with these massive settlements and the walls and the roads and the entire infrastructure. And so, having traveled sort of north-south in the West Bank through Jerusalem for a month in March, you can see the project on the ground very clearly. It's hard to imagine that, let's say Obama, you know, created a rift with Israel, got things going, brought in the Arab states, created international momentum for a peace process between Palestinians and Israelis headed towards a two-state solution, which I think is their strategy. What's at the end of the line? A two-state solution, whatever two-state solution they would come up with, would probably be fragmented sort of Bantustan ghettos for Palestinians. I can't imagine politically or territorially creating a contiguous sovereign Palestinian state with Israel removing all of the settlements, all of the infrastructure, decolonizing basically a 40 to 50 year colonial project. It's just hard to imagine.
We're talking to Professor Steve Niebuhr, who is Professor of International Politics and Middle East Studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Professor Niebuhr, I want to get back to this idea that the two-state solution is really no longer viable, that the two-state solution is dead. And Jimmy Carter and others have talked about the apartheid system in Israel. Can you talk to our listeners about what you observed personally?
Yeah. Well, when we talk about Israel's occupation, you know, we tend to talk about Israel's military rule over the native population that of Palestinians that live in the West Bank, and we also talk about Gaza, but I'm going to focus on the West Bank here. And we tend to think of it simply as like the U.S. in Iraq, where you have a foreign military force ruling over another people. Yes, you have that in the case of the West Bank. We have 2.5 million Palestinians, another million, 0.5 in Gaza. Yes, you have that. But what you also have is Israel has installed since the early 70s, and particularly since the late 70s, a huge network of over 120 settlements built into the earth, into the ground, that have fragmented and bisected Palestinian lives, Palestinian communities, built between and around and behind, etc., creating this sort of ghetto sort of system that I'm talking about. It's also put in a road infrastructure that only serves the settlement population. And it's recently started building a wall that 89% or 88% of which is deep in Palestinian territory, trying to put some of those settlements behind. But you still have the settlements on the other side of the wall, on the Palestinian side of the wall. In addition, when we're talking about Israel's occupation, not only the settlements, not only the wall, not only the roads and infrastructure, you're also talking about an entire legal regime in which Jewish settlers can go anywhere they want. They have military escort and access if they need. Whereas, on the other hand, Palestinians are subject to over 5,000 to 6,000 to 7,000 military orders regarding every aspect of their lives. For example, only 7% of Palestinian private vehicles can leave their small area that's surrounded by settlements and probably has a wall on one side, maybe even surrounded entirely by a wall on another side. In other words, Palestinians are subject to a whole series of laws and regulations that limit themselves to their tiny territorial enclave, whereas, let's say, a Jewish American who makes aliyah to Israel immediately becomes a citizen and has rights of free and a free mobility anywhere, plus with government subsidies. So what you've created is a two-tiered legal system in which one side, those who can claim Israeli citizenship, have complete laws, rights, and freedoms, and the other side is subject to entirely negative laws that restrict freedoms. And, I mean, this really is the core of the issue. The core of the issue is, on the one hand, ending Israel's occupation, but more, I think, at a deeper level, what I see is it's really about the right of self-determination and freedom for Palestinians. I mean, really, to me, that's the core of the issue.
Could you talk specifically about the most recent conflict between the U.S. and the Netanyahu government, and that is over this West Bank corridor known as E1. There's an article in Haaretz this morning about this confrontation and about the threat of very large-scale building projects. What's the significance of this West Bank corridor?
Well, it's part of this broader process that's going on, which is what Israel's doing right now. And it's not just coming from one place. I mean, we have a very entrenched network of interests that are engaged in this occupation process of basically erasing Palestinian life and stretching and expanding Israeli Jewish life in particular and their infrastructure across the territory. And the E1 corridor basically sits between Jerusalem and the Dead Sea, that is going east towards Jordan. And what it does is, it's E1 refers to this particular slice of land to the east of Jerusalem, and what it does is it bisects the northwest bank from the southwest bank. And it already has a huge settlement called Mali Adumim, which has about 45 to 50,000 Israelis live there at this time. But it would complete sort of the cutting of the West Bank in two and contribute to the encirclement of Jerusalem. And this is really important because what's happened, and you see it very clearly when you spend any time in Jerusalem right now, is Israel has completely cut off Jerusalem from the West Bank, from going north to Ramallah, Nablus, all the big cities, Palestinian cities, and to the south, to Bethlehem, Hebron, and other cities. Basically, a Palestinian living in the West Bank can no longer go to Jerusalem. It's nearly impossible unless they get a special permit, and usually that requires some form of collaboration or some kind of political trade-off for them. It makes it nearly impossible. Israel is also clamping down on Palestinians living in Jerusalem from going to the West Bank as well. It's cutting off Jerusalem forever from Palestinian life. And this E1 corridor is simply cementing that process, right? And remember, they're cutting off Jerusalem. They're bisecting the Palestinian state on the one hand. On the other hand, as I'm trying to suggest, the rest of the West Bank is also getting cut into tiny little pieces surrounded by Israel settlements, surrounded by the infrastructure of roads and so on. So is it significant? Obama administration has said, and actually I take their word on this one, although we'll see what happens, you know, because they've said that any kind of Israeli expansion of settlements, whether that's creating new ones or expanding within existing ones, that should be stopped. And it seems to me, because I think they really feel like they have to get this process going now, and they're going to have to start by getting Israel to budge by either bringing down the Netanyahu government or by forcing Netanyahu to go ahead and leave his existing ideology of actually, for once, pulling back on settlements. I think they're going to stand up to him on this one. It'll be interesting to see. But like we've just talked about, where it will go, it's headed towards this, you know, an idea of a two-state solution. And meanwhile, Israel is creating the conditions that make that, I think, nearly impossible.
Professor Neva, you wouldn't know it listening to the Netanyahu-Lieberman regime that there has been a rift between them and the Obama administration. Both continue to assure Israelis that all is going well, that all disagreements are being resolved in Israel's favor. What is going on there in terms of there seems to be a disconnect between what is really happening between the Obama administration and Netanyahu-Lieberman and what those two leaders are representing to the Israeli public?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things going on. On the one hand, you see, this is why, I mean, on this settlement freeze issue, it's actually kind of interesting strategically to think about because, you know, as I've been describing, a settlement freeze really doesn't get at the core issues of the conflict. It doesn't get at the core issues of what's preventing Palestinians from having, you know, living in any kind of freedom. You know, a settlement freeze is actually a small thing. But it's actually a huge thing for Lieberman and Netanyahu. Netanyahu is the prime minister. Lieberman's his foreign minister. Lieberman comes from an extreme right-wing, very racist party. A settlement freeze is huge for them because what keeps them in power right now is the support of the far right, the pro-settler movement in Israel. And so so from their political point of view, if they give in to Obama on this issue, their coalition is probably over and there'll probably be new elections. So what they're trying to do, and this is your question to me, I think, is, you know, they're trying to put on a happy face. They're trying to say, no, we don't have a crisis with the U.S. We're working things out. And what they're trying to do is cover their tracks. They're trying not to go either one way or the other. And then the second thing is, I mean, basically they're going to try and stall. The second thing is that relationships with America are very popular in Israel. I mean, history has shown, and I think Bush Sr. showed this, that when the U.S. puts pressure on Israel, actually many Israelis will actually move in that direction to what Israel, what the U.S. might be demanding, because they're very fearful, and I think a lot of it's been from propaganda over the years of existential threats and so on from, you know, various countries outside, but they're very fearful of losing that tight, close, special relationship with the U.S. And therefore, Lieberman and Netanyahu don't want to create this rift with the U.S. because it's very unpopular, I mean, to be honest with you. And they're saying things now that they say, well, we could live without U.S. support, we could be independent, so on, but it's really nonsense, and also politically it's unviable.
Steve, I wonder if you could talk about how archaeology and what are called the heritage sites are being used to further Israeli expansion into the territories.
Right. Well, as I've been saying, what's going on right now is still to this moment, as we speak, Israel is deepening this sort of ghettoization of Palestinian life, expanding settlements, expanding infrastructure, and so on. And really at the heart of this project right now is an attempt by a network of interests, of Israeli interests, to essentially create a new demographic situation in the city of Jerusalem, whereby there's a Jewish majority in East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is a part of Jerusalem occupied by Israel. There still is a majority of Palestinians there. Palestinians believe this should be the future capital of an independent Palestine. According to international law, Israel is in occupation of East Jerusalem. And Israel is trying very hard in a variety of different ways right now to increase Israeli settlement expansion, demolish Palestinian homes, limit their growth, etc. And one of the ways it's doing this is through expanding heritage sites throughout East Jerusalem that claim to have some link to ancient Jewish history, particularly the First Temple period of David, King David, and Solomon. And one of the worst examples of this is called City of David Archaeological Park, which is right next to the holiest sites where the Temple Mount is, the Haram al-Sharif, the third holy site in Islam, the holy site in the Jewish tradition, the Wailing Wall, and right near the holy Christian sites. On the basis of very flimsy archaeological evidence, a couple pots and a couple pieces of an alleged wall of some structure from dating back to 6th, 7th, 8th century, a settler group that claims to be pursuing Jewish heritage in Jerusalem has basically established this whole theme park, and I visited it. It's like a Disneyland theme park with all kinds of 3D movies and so on and so forth, right in the heart of the Arab area of Silwan, which is a key neighborhood in Jerusalem. And they've started to expand, and now there are orders for the demolition of about 100 houses in this area that's alleged to be King Solomon's garden. And that would affect over 1,000 Palestinians would have to be displaced to demolish their homes, which Israel claims that are built illegally. And this is going on all over, where what will happen is Jewish groups will come in, and this one's funded by Irving Moskowitz, the American bingo magnate from Miami. They'll come in, and they'll claim that there's a heritage connection to a spot. They'll get government control. They'll get government backup for this, and then they'll push their settler agenda. And we're seeing this in Sheikh Jarrah, which is in North Jerusalem. We're seeing this in, near the Mount of Olives. You're seeing it all over, where heritage becomes part of colonization, essentially. And when I was there, I saw a large number of what appeared to me to be American Jewish groups from the Birthright Israel program, which gives free trips to American Jewish youngsters to go to Israel, to see Israel. And it deeply concerned me, and I thought, this is contributing to the project of displacement, and actually this is contributing to preventing a peaceful solution to this conflict. And it seems to me many people may know about the Birthright Israel program, but I think people need to raise questions about it. What is it contributing to? And these heritage parks are sort of becoming a magnet for these kinds of trips.
Professor Niba, I want to focus a bit on Gaza in light of the horrors of the most recent attack. You had written an article, War of Choice, How Israel Manufactured the Gaza Escalation, that was published in Foreign Policy and Focus. Can you talk about the your thinking in terms of Israel using a pretext to attack Gaza, and why would Israel do that?
Right. Well, the key issue here is Israel claimed that it had to go to war. It was a war of no choice. It was a war of necessity because it claimed that it was being attacked by a barrage of rockets and mortars from Gaza. And that was the line that was widely repeated in the media. And what I did was I actually looked at the pattern of rocket fire. This is one of the main things I do, is sort of track attacks going both ways and look at cause and effect and so on. And if you track the rocket fire coming from Gaza, there's two key issues. The first one is that when Israel initially withdrew from Gaza in 2005, rocket fire and mortar fire that had been increasing from Gaza into Israel actually took a steep decline. In fact, after Israel withdrew initially, Hamas and Palestinian groups did not immediately launch a war against Israel. In fact, it declined. When rocket fire increased is after Hamas won the elections. In the Palestinian elections became the majority party in amongst Palestinians in early 2006, and Israel, along with the United States, imposed an embargo on the Palestinian government, an embargo on Gaza. It began sanctions and an embargo on the Gaza Strip. That's when rocket fire increases. Then let's move to the second point, which is in 2008, in the summer of 2008, six months before the Israel's war on Gaza, the Israelis and Palestinians agreed to a ceasefire in June 2008. And in fact, what you see is Palestinian rocket fire trickled to nearly zero. In fact, in August, ceasefire was June, in August, September, and October, there was probably under five rockets fired, and they were all done by Islamic Jihad or some, you know, not Hamas, certainly. Hamas kept the ceasefire. Israelis experienced the greatest period of peace, of no attacks, that they'd experienced in 6 years, those living in the south near Gaza. So, but the deal was Palestinians would refrain from rocket fire if Israel ended the siege, this embargo on Gaza, and Israel did not. And then Israel attacked Hamas targets, an alleged tunnel being built in Gaza on the very day Barack Obama was elected, on November 4th. And that's what finally started the rocket fire again, leading, of course, to the war in December. And I guess here's the point I'm trying to make, is that there was a very viable alternative to waging war in the name of self-defense against Palestinians in Gaza. And that was this process of a negotiated ceasefire. Palestinian militant groups would agree to a ceasefire if Israel lifted the siege in Gaza. And this leads to the final part of your question, which is, so then why did Israel choose war rather than easing the siege of Gaza? And I think it's very clear because there's two reasons. The first is Israel's military had been under...
Steve, we have about a minute, so
okay.
You're going to have to
I'll
wrap
just
up.
Wrap this up. Basically, Israel's military had been under criticism for allegedly losing a war to Hezbollah, and it needed a chance to assert what they called deterrence, putting fear into your enemy. But secondly, the idea was to make Gaza ungovernable. The idea is to bring Hamas down and to turn the people against it and to destroy the infrastructure of Gaza. And that's what that war was about. It was about destroying the infrastructure of Gaza and creating essentially anarchy and chaos. But there was an alternative, which was easing the embargo and the sanctions. And that would have solved the problem.
We've been talking to Steve Neva, Professor of International Politics and Middle East Studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. We could talk for many hours more with you, Steve. So
yeah.
We're hoping you will come back to One Land, Many Voices at a future show.
Thank you. I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
And now we turn to our next guest this morning, but I think I'd like to make at least one announcement of an event, a very important event that's happening this Saturday. So if our guest would just indulge us just a moment more. The action is Portland Stands with Iran. A local ad hoc committee of nonpartisan ordinary citizens will join more than 80 cities around the world for an international day of action in solidarity with the people of Iran. That's July 25th, this Saturday, July 25th at 1 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland.
And with us by telephone is Jamal Nassar, who is Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences at California State University, San Bernardino. Born in Jerusalem, Professor Nassar has established himself as a leading authority on the politics of the Middle East. His many publications include such books as Globalization and Terrorism, The Migration of Dreams and Nightmares, Politics and Culture in the Developing World, Intifada, Palestine at the Crossroads, The Palestine Liberation Organization, From Armed Struggle to the Declaration of Independence, and Change Without Borders, The Third World at the End of the 20th Century. Dr. Nassar, thank you so much for joining us today on One Land, Many Voices.
It is my pleasure, Hala.
Dr. Nassar, it's been nearly 20 years since you wrote with co-author Robert Heacock, Intifada, Palestine at the Crossroads. I wonder if we could start with a discussion of where you think the Palestinian resistance stands today. We've just been discussing the ongoing Israeli government projects of dispossession and consolidation in the West Bank. How are Palestinians, both individually and through the Palestinian Authority or Fatah or Hamas, resisting the occupation today?
Well, the resistance, of course, continues, but the Israelis were able to divert it and change the whole process of resistance with the Oslo Accords. With the Intifada, the Israelis discovered that they were not able to rule the people in the West Bank, Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. So what they opted for is to continue to rule the land while bringing in another authority, a Palestinian authority, to rule the population that was beyond the Israeli control. And consequently, Israeli resistance, Palestinian resistance to Israeli expansionism and continued occupation of the land waned, and the Palestinians ended up being split, as we know today, into Hamas and Fatah, into West Bank Palestinian Authority versus Gaza Hamas rule.
Professor Nassar, can you talk a little bit about the Palestinian woman's role in Palestinian resistance?
Well, Palestinian women have had a major role. They have really set an example for revolutionary activities, for leadership. For example, during the Intifada, in which Dr. Seaman started with, most of the men, one out of every three Palestinian men, had been jailed for some time or another. It was the women who carried through that Intifada. It was them who organized, who had to support the family, who organized in the communities in order to produce alternative means for the people to survive. Women have been pioneers, Palestinian women, and their activities have been imitated by many others around the world. And I have witnessed all kinds of cases and situations of heroism of Palestinian women during that intifada. And it continues until this day. As you remember, in the very first election for president of the Palestinian Authority, we had two major candidates. One was Yasser Arafat, and the other was Mrs. Samiha Khalil, a woman. And she got almost 12% of the vote. She was definitely very well liked in the community. She was a tremendous community leader. The work she had done continues even after her death many years ago. She has been a wonderful woman, and my own family has been very involved. I know my sister-in-law, Maha Nassar, was a leader of a Palestinian women's movement that created all kinds of cooperatives in the communities, child care centers, educational centers in villages and in cities throughout the West Bank and Gaza. The work of women has been really pioneering in the Palestinian struggle.
Dean Nassar, you mentioned your family and your personal history. Can you talk a bit about, I understand your family is Christian Palestinian. Can you talk a bit about what's happening in Jerusalem and what's happening to Christian Palestinians in the West Bank as well as inside the Green Line?
Yeah, well, Jerusalem, as you know, has been occupied, the old city of Jerusalem, what they call East Jerusalem, has been occupied since 67, and from the early days of the occupation, Israel annexed East Jerusalem after enlarging its borders, of course, and began to construct settlements throughout and declared it the eternal capital of Israel, clearly in violation of international law and many UN Security Council resolutions. That process never stopped. In fact, right now, the Israelis are insisting on building another major settlement in the midst of the Arab part of East Jerusalem and Sheikh Jarrah. And the Palestinians are losing their ID cards. Many of them are being their ID cards are taken away from them. They cannot add to their houses. They cannot build new houses because they need permit from the Israeli city council, and the Israeli city will not offer Palestinians or allow Palestinians permits to construct their homes or to remodel their homes. So the Palestinians are being forcefully driven out of Jerusalem, be they Christian or Muslim. It does not make a difference. It has not made a difference to the Israelis from the beginning. Palestinian Christians have been, just like Muslim Christians, driven out from the West Bank, left and right. The pressure is on them constantly. And what irritates me most whenever I go there to live there, stay there, or to visit, is when I see American Christian tourists going to see old structures, old churches, buildings, and so on, the Holy Sepulcher, the Gethsemane, the Church of Nativity. It seems that these tourists, all they care about is some deaf and dumb stones rather than the human beings. Rarely any of them would ask, how about the Christians who use this church? Are they still around? What is their situation? They don't seem to bother there. And that is rather irritating because American Christians seem to have forgotten about the Christians of the Holy Land.
And you're listening to One Land, Many Voices this morning. You're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. And naturally also available as streaming audio at KBOO's website at kboo.fm. And our guest this morning on One Land, Many Voices is Dr. Jamal Nassar. He is Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences at California State University, San Bernardino. Dr. Nassar, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, as our first guest did, the changes or perhaps the potential changes in U.S. policy towards this conflict with the arrival of the Obama administration.
Well, there is not a fundamental change, no doubt, but there is some hope with the Obama administration. Fundamentally, U.S. policy has always stood for a two-state solution. But we know that two-state solution has bypassed this. Israel has made sure that the two-state solution will not work. They have created settlements, roadblocks, checkpoints throughout, military encampments throughout the West Bank, making the two-state solution a rather impossibility at this point. A recent UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs found that almost 40% of the West Bank is now taken by Israeli infrastructure, the roads, settlements, military bases, and so on. Largely, these are off-limits to the Palestinians. So Israel has methodically broken the remainder of the territory into dozens of enclaves separated from each other and outside the world by zones that it alone controls. So the idea of a two-state solution is something of the past. We have one land, we have two peoples, and eventually we have to realize that both have to share that land. So the Obama administration still is on that old policy, no fundamental change. What has changed is the style, is the approach. For example, he is now more willing and open to speak about the Israeli violations, especially when it comes to settlements. He's demanding a freeze on settlements. That is very significant. While previous administrations have done that, they didn't act on it. It seems like he is putting the pressure. He's opening up the way. And to me, that opens a window for those of us in the United States who are willing to speak up against Israeli violations of international law and human rights of the Palestinians, in that no more are we going to be perceived as just those radicals, those extremists who are always attacking Israeli policies. Now it is possible for us to say Israel is wrong. After all, the President of the United States is saying Israel is wrong. So it is time for those forces, those progressives in this country who care about human rights and about justice in that part of the world to speak up, to organize, and to get moving. Our movement now can be seen more legitimate, and we can drive our way into mainstream America that has been deprived of hearing the Palestinian narrative. Mainstream America is only familiar with the Israeli narrative. History, as you know, is often written not by heroes. History, rather, is more often written by those who hang heroes. And the narrative in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has been written by the Israelis, by the oppressors, by the occupiers.
Dr. Nassar, I'd like to focus in on this question of the death of the two-state solution, if you'll forgive my putting it so dramatically. My impression is that those who continue to want to consider the two-state solution believe that the one-state solution also poses significant obstacles. You've described, and our previous guest described, how the Israeli infrastructure, the Israeli building, the Israeli breaking up of the West Bank into these Bantustans has essentially created insurmountable obstacle to a two-state, a viable two-state solution. But the one-state solution has its own set of challenges. I wonder if you could address those. I mean, for example, a colleague of mine said, yeah, well, there already is a one-state solution. It's called Israel. How do you respond to the concerns that the one-state solution is also equally inaccessible to us today?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I do not see the one-state solution coming about in a day or in a year or 5 years or 15. That's a long-term objective. Clearly, the conflict itself is driven from its origins, from day one, by Zionists' exclusive sense of entitlement to the land. They feel that this is their land, God gave it to them, and so on, and they want a purely Jewish state. And that will make the one-state solution very difficult. So Israel basically an exclusivist state that has tried to defy the multicultural history of the land in which it was founded. The Palestinians have to move their struggle into an apartheid anti-apartheid kind of struggle, a demand for civil rights, a demand for equality on the land, and the demand for the rights of the Palestinian refugees, too, to return under international law, under every norm, under UN security, under UN Assembly and Security Council resolutions. These Palestinian refugees have every right to return to their homeland. And in fact, the admission of Israel to the United Nations was conditional on Israel's implementation of previous resolutions allowing the refugees to return. That has never been implemented. So the nature of the struggle is likely to shift in another direction, and with the help of many open-minded, liberal, progressive Israelis, I believe the struggle is not going to be simply a Palestinian struggle. It's going to be a joint Palestinian-Jewish struggle for justice within the state of Israel. Regardless of the name of the state, the Palestinians must have equal rights on their own land, just like the Israeli settlers who came in from Europe or other parts of the world. So it's a long-term struggle, no doubt. Apartheid did not end in a year or two or a decade or two. It took a long time. It will take also support from the international community. And the struggle against apartheid also incorporated divestment from the South African apartheid regime. It incorporated boycotts, and we all could participate in that. We all could be asking questions as to where is this coming from and why am I supporting product produced in a settlement, in a colony, basically. So that is something that we could work on in the United States, and it is high time that we begin to work. And our work in this country has already begun to move in many directions. It's not Palestinians struggling alone. Many American Jewish groups are working very hard alongside the Palestinians. I think your show itself is a good example of that. So I believe we have room to now make it a human rights kind of struggle.
Dr. Nassar, I want to share with you that many of my Palestinian friends do not have a difficult time imagining a one secular democratic state for all Palestinians with the right of return, as well as all Israeli Jews. This may appear to many as a pie-in-the-sky kind of dream, and you've addressed it some in terms of how long it will take. How about you personally? Are you a two-stater, or are you a person who wants to see one secular democratic state?
Well, if you read some of my works, my previous works going back to the 80s and early 90s, I supported the two-state solution with the right of refugees to return or be compensated. But since then, I have come to the realization, if you want to pinpoint it, the year 2000 when Eric Sharon came to power, and massive, rampant movement to colonize the West Bank and Jerusalem, definitely, made it clear that the two-state solution went on life support, like Sharon himself. And since then, I believe it has died. So I have moved along, and I have become a supporter of a human solution rather than a nationalist solution, a solution based on the fundamental rights of human beings, of people, rather than the rights of nations.
Dr. Nassar, you've been in academia for decades now. Many who are in academia who have criticized Israeli policies have faced attacks against them personally as well as professionally. I can think of people like Norm Finkelstein, Nadia Abulhaj, John Massad, and many others. Have you yourself been a target of such attacks?
Of course. I came to this country in 1966. And it was not easy as a student. I have been called all kinds of names. I received all kinds of calls, death threats over the years. As a professor, I also faced all kinds of difficulties, but luckily for me, my career was more in state universities, smaller state universities that are not too dependent on private funding. And maybe that made a little difference, but also I had many friends who stood with me, supported me, ensured that I got my tenure and I got my promotion in spite of the opposition and the crisis that few tried to create on campuses. Now, as I came to Cal State University right here in Southern California, this is a very diverse campus, very open-minded campus, and I really love it here. And I have not faced any harassment in the last 2 years since I moved to Cal State.
Dr. Nassar, you've mentioned earlier in our conversation boycott, sanctions, divestment. That's a campaign that encompasses a lot of different strategies. What is your impression of progress in that particular line of activism here in the United States, and perhaps maybe more particularly your view from the college campuses of the country?
Well, it's slow. The progress is extremely slow. It takes a long time for such activities to build up and to gain momentum. We're not there yet. But the campaign started more than 10 years ago, to the campaign for divestment, for example. And we just have to keep on until it catches up sooner or later. It is going to catch up sooner or later. Corporations are going to pay attention. They have to pay attention if they're going to be socially responsible. And we can push them in that direction. But it takes more people to join in, more people to say, yes, I cannot support this product or this company because it is made on a settlement in the occupied territories. I cannot support this product because it is a product that has been killing innocent people in Gaza or somewhere else. I think the movement in that direction has to grow, and sooner or later it will gain the momentum like the activities against apartheid in South Africa did. The Israeli rule over Jerusalem and the West Bank is a clear situation of apartheid. I mean, Israel cannot hide it anymore. The discrimination is clear. The blockade of the Palestinians in Gaza and in their villages and towns in the West Bank is very clear. And the similarities with South Africa, apartheid South Africa, are very, very obvious now. We need to let the people know about that. And I believe many Israelis will join us in that, as well as many in the American Jewish community. And they are moving in that direction. But sooner or later, it will gain momentum. And when it gains momentum, just like the international support for the Palestinians, we do not know that. Most Americans have no idea that the international community is overwhelmingly on the side of the Palestinians. Because over here, mainstream America basically gives us the Israeli narrative. We need to let them know that Israel is in violation of 74 United Nations Security Council resolutions. When Iraq was in violation of 19 of those, we invaded Iraq. But Israel in continuous violation of 74 of Security Council resolutions, we still aid and support Israel. Israel continues to be the number one recipient of U.S. foreign aid. We have to change that formula, and we can do it working together, working with our friends in this country who care about the dignity of the human being.
Dr. Nassar, a couple of the companies that we often hear about in relation to boycott, sanction, divestment efforts are the Caterpillar Company, which manufactures these huge bulldozers that are used to destroy Palestinian homes and are often not even, I mean, they are essentially a weapon of war that's used against Palestinians, but also Motorola. And another company that that I think has been more controversial in terms of being targeted as a for the boycott is Starbucks Coffee. Can you talk about what kind of principles the campaign uses in terms of identifying companies to be an effective boycott, and to be most persuasive in terms of generating support for the boycotts?
I think the basic principles, and I have been, I lived in Illinois for 29 years, and I participated in the campaign against Caterpillar. I even met with the leaders of Caterpillar among the group of other people pushing for that boycott. I think the basic principles is that those who contribute to the death machine of Israel, Caterpillar's activities contribute to that death machine, the destruction of Palestinian homes at the hands of these products of Caterpillar. In terms of Starbucks, it has to do more with the support of the settlement activities and support of the colonization, the confiscation of Palestinian land, and the construction of the, exclusively Jewish settlements on these lands. That's where Starbucks comes in. So I think the basic principles have to remain focused on basic violations of elementary laws in humanitarian, international humanitarian law, as well as the laws of war. So I think we can focus that in a direction that will appeal to more people and within Israel and within the United States. And I think down the road we can succeed in a campaign like this. And I'm very happy with the progress it has done. In Britain, for example, they're way ahead of us. They have been rather successful in comparison to our action in the United States. So that has to be a move we have to make in the United States, move big in that direction.
We are talking to Dr. Jamal Nassar, Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences at California State University, San Bernardino. It is interesting to me, Dr. Nassar, that you focus on the Israelis who are working toward a just peace. I was recently reading about the Israeli combat soldiers breaking the silence who published a report about the most recent Gaza war, the attack on Gaza, where they talk about the massive bombardment of buildings and neighborhoods and mosques and schools and police stations, over 1,400 killed, the majority civilians. So we are seeing a change in Israeli society on some level, but I'm disheartened to see certain studies about Israeli society. The Israeli Jews who, for example, one study showed that 80% of whom would not want to live in the same building as Palestinian Arabs, that there seems to be a swing to the right in Israeli society. Can you address how it is that you seem to have hope when you come against these kinds of statistics and information?
Yeah, definitely you are right in terms of the average Israeli. I'm not really talking about the average Israeli. Israel has been swinging to the right since the mid to late 70s, and that swing has not stopped. It continues. And it took a major leap in 2000 with the election of Eric Sharon to the prime ministry. And now clearly we see it with Netanyahu. Israel has clearly gone to the right in general. In terms of its public, they have gone to the right. Otherwise, they will not elect people like that. People who advocate the expulsion of the Palestinians are members in the Knesset at a regular basis. People who advocate all types of outrageous exclusivist activities are leaders in the Israeli society. So what we need to do is work with those Israelis who are a minority, clearly, but those Israelis who care about the dignity of the human being rather than the nationalist aspirations of exclusivist Zionism. And those are growing in number. We've seen now with the Israeli soldiers you mentioned. We've seen it before with many other Israeli soldiers who refuse to serve in the occupied territories and instead went to jail. We've seen it with, we continue to see it with the women in black. We see so many Israeli human rights outfits advocating for the rights of the Palestinians as well. So these are inroads that Palestinian activists need to work with, American activists need to work with as well, in order to enlarge that number of people in the state of Israel, where down the road, someday, hopefully, that will be the majority. We cannot live without hope. We have to have hope.
And on that note,
we will not have a chance.
On that note, we want to thank Professor Jamal Nassar, Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences at Cal State University at San Bernardino. Thank you so much, Dr. Nassar.
Thank you both.
And thank you also to our earlier guests, Professor Steve Naiva of Evergreen University up in Olympia, Washington. I want to make one more announcement before we leave this morning, and that is about the Iranian Festival 2009, the 10th annual Iranian Festival, Saturday, August 1st, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the South Park Blocks, Portland State University. Again, that's the Iranian Festival happening Saturday, August 1st. From 10 to 6 p.m. at the South Park Blocks here in Portland. And I think we ought to at least mention one more time what's happening on Saturday.
That will be tomorrow, Will. Portland Stands with Iran, a local ad hoc committee of nonpartisan ordinary citizens, will join more than 80 cities around the world for the International Day of Action in solidarity with the people of Iran. That's July 25th. Tomorrow, Saturday, at Pioneer Square. I will see you there, hopefully at 1 p.m.
And you've been listening again to One Land, Many Voices. You're tuned to KBOO. If you've missed any of our previous programs or you just want to listen again to one of our past guests, all of our programs are available on demand at pdxjustice.org. That's pdxjustice.org. And, of course, at kbu.fm. KBOO's home webpage here in Portland. And we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to write to us with questions or suggestions for guests or topics, write to us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. Thanks so much for tuning in.